This is the Medic Cast, February 22nd, 2010.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this episode of the Medic Cast. I'm Jamie Davis, the pod medic. This is episode 207 here at the Medic Cast as we roll into the end of February in 2010. And we got a lot planned for this episode and a lot of information in it. Good news coming up for those of you that might be attending conferences in the near future. We've got some opportunities. We may be able to meet up with each of you. Looking forward to that. And I'll have more on that later in this episode. First off, I want to remind you, you can find all of the information we talk about here, the links to the news items, links to any of the tip resources we talk about in this show, all available over at medicast.com/blog. And you can find that there. Right at the top of the page is a link for the show notes. And click on that. Most recent episode will show up first. Then you can scroll down and find previous episodes and go back in time to look at what has happened in the past. If you're looking for a past episode, you can also always search for a specific topic on the search right there on the blog as well. And you can find past episodes that way. Also, don't forget, you can always leave a comment over at the MedicCast site beneath any of the articles, any of the show notes entries, as well as anything else posted there. We love to hear back from you and share your comments there. It's a great way for you to reach out to the rest of the visitors to the site and give them an opportunity to respond back to your comments. So I urge you to do that. If you'd like to comment directly, send me email in or voicemail, you can do that as well. And again, the email address here, podmedic@mac.com. You can also just go ahead and send me a voicemail on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. I said I had some news to share with you later, and now's the time. We're going to be, myself and Chris Bonterra from the EMS Garage podcast are going to be recording our shows live down at the EMS Today conference in Baltimore. We've been invited in by the conference organizers, GEMS, the Journal of Emergency Medical Services. I'm excited about this opportunity to get down to the conference to meet all of the listeners that are going to be there. So if you're going to be attending the conference, you definitely want to stop by the booth, catch up with myself, Chris Bonterra. We'll have some other assorted EMS social media dignitaries on, including we're hoping to squirrel away Justin Shore and Mark Glencourse for an interview about the Chronicles of EMS program and the first EMS TV reality show that really is reality. We show it how it is because it's shot by us for us. So they're going to be at the Zoll booth and going to be hanging out there, but we're going to try to get them on the show as well. So if you can't get to them at the Zoll booth, you can try to catch them up with them with us. And we'll be talking about that more. If you want to find out more specifically when we're going to be there, I know we're going to be recording twice on Friday and twice on Saturday morning. You can find out more in your conference materials when you get there. And you can also check out, we're going to be near the GEMS booth right next door or attached to the GEMS booth itself in the exhibit hall. And we will be, of course, updating via Twitter and Facebook as well. So if you follow me, PodMedic, on either of those, you can get updated information for when I'm going to be performing, what we're talking about, and everything else. And definitely, please, if you see me, and just hang out, stop by, come up and introduce yourself, and I'd love to meet everybody that's going to be there. So stop by the booth and say hello. Let's jump in with some listener email. And I picked up an email this week from listener James. He's a medic in Mississippi, enjoys the podcast, and was having an idea about topics and calling in with some questions or emailing in with some questions. So James, first off, great to hear from you. And he was checking in because he's feeling under the weather and sick, and his service doesn't offer any kind of primary care coverage. They just offer major medical insurance. And he wondered, what the case was with other services and how we felt about sick days, people in the healthcare industry. Why are we expected to work when we're sick? Well, you're expected to work when we're sick because your boss is shorthanded and they don't have enough people to cover. And they don't really care if you pass something on to the patient because it's all about patient transport and billing. Okay, there I said it. So send your emails to podmedic@mac.com. But let's be honest here. I mean, most EMTs and paramedics are, considered working stiffs. And if you don't come in to work and you're sick, nobody really cares whether you make the patient sick or not. And they can call and tell me that that's not the case. And I'll just point out the fact then, why do you give people a hard time when they're not feeling good about not coming to work and not providing coverage and the information and access people need to get good health care when you're part of the healthcare system? All right. So there I said it. James, there's no easy answer to this. In fact, most of the American workplace doesn't offer a good view of people who take sick days. I mean, hey, we're supposed to tough it out. And, if you don't go the extra mile and get in there and put your time in, no matter how sick you are, you're not really dedicated to your company, right? Well, in other parts of the world, it is considered a huge insult and very rude to go into the workplace sick and expose your coworkers and others to whatever illness you might have. I don't know why we don't feel that way. And certainly, I think by encouraging people to come to work sick, we probably lose more time by other people getting sick than we would by just letting someone stay out for a day or two. So, like I said, there's no easy answer, but I really do think it just comes down to money. I also heard in from our long-term friend, from Rick Rosati of the Mitigation Journal podcast. For those of you out there that don't listen to Rick's podcast, it's about being prepared for major response, whether it's a natural disaster, terrorist response, whatever. He looks at all sections of the response community, from your civilian response teams, your first responders on the street, fire, EMS, police, and all the way up to hospitals, health departments, and emergency services. And Rick was checking in to get some insights from me on our recent snowstorm here in the Mid-Atlantic area and how we were dealing with that event and how it affected response times, how it affected the economics of our community. And I was able to hook Rick up after he got in touch with me with an email. I was able to hook Rick up with our own Director of Emergency Services, Richard Brooks, and he was able to chat with Rick and I in a phone interview that Rick's going to be featuring later this week. So if you're listening to this right after we posted it, you can head over to mitigationjournal.com, and sometime later this week, Rick will be posting that particular episode. You can also find his podcast over at iTunes as well, and you want to definitely check that out because it is an opportunity for you to hear a little bit about what goes on farther up the food chain than a lot of us on the street get an eye on, and really help us understand why we don't always get the resources we need, why some of the decisions are being made because of just extenuating circumstances that, I know I didn't even think of some of the stuff that Richard brought up, and I live in this area. So he was looking at things in my own region that I hadn't really considered, but then that's his job. If you don't catch it at Rick's site over at mitigationjournal.com, I actually am going to include that particular interview in a future episode here on the MedicCast in the next few weeks, maybe to help give me a break while I'm down at the EMS Today conference, since I won't have a lot of time to record from the home studio to prepare for that weekend. But look for that either here or head over to mitigationjournal.com, mitigationjournal.com, for Rick's interview with Richard Brooks, and I got to participate and listen in to what I thought was a fascinating discussion on local emergency planning and management. The final listener email I picked up is from a brand new listener from New Zealand. Godfrey checked in to catch up with me a couple of weeks ago and was checking in. Basically, I think he was trying to catch me because I always say I try to respond and reply back to every email, even if it's just a short response. I don't think he believed I really did. And he sent me an email and I just happened to coincide with when I was looking right at my email. So I responded back to him pretty quickly. I won't always be able to respond back that quickly, folks, but I did get back to him and he kind of laughed about it in a responding email to me saying, yeah, I didn't really think, you know, I guess you really do answer your people back. So anyway, he sent me a follow-up email to ask a question about something we do here in the U.S. He was watching the recently released Chronicles of EMS pilot episode starring Justin Shore from San Francisco Fire Department and Mark Glencourse from the U.K., and they were looking at how the electronic patient care report is done in San Francisco. And Godfrey wanted to know, is that something that happens a lot here in the States? Do we all have, you know, little tablets that we do our reports on, or some kind of electronic patient report? And they do all paper reports where he is. And of course, I responded back to him, and I wanted to check back in with you to let you know that, yeah, not everywhere in the United States does that. I don't even think most places do. But a lot of people are switching over to some form of electronic report. It saves on paper and storage. It's much more durable and can be protected well, and you can do it in multiple locations. So you can put a laptop in the vehicle and people can respond while on the street without having to come back to station all the time to do the reporting. And so this was something that we see a lot of, but there are plenty of places out there doing patient care reports on paper. The other question he asked was, what does BSI mean? BSI is a common question I get from people that aren't in, I guess, even my region of the U.S. Not everybody in the U.S. does this, but as an instructor here, former student here, one of the things we do to make sure people are constantly aware of universal precautions for body fluids and also making sure that they're aware of scene safety. Instead of using gloves for every single practice session, we just get in the habit of saying scene safety BSI before we get started with a scenario. And it's supposed to help us remember and state to a preceptor that, hey, we're thinking about this, but we're just not going to waste gloves on a practice session on a mannequin or something like that. So that's what BSI is. Body substance isolation is what it stands for. Godfrey, thanks for your email, and I look forward to hearing more from you. Tell me a little bit more about what you're doing down there in the New Zealand EMS system. Time to jump into this week's news. I'm going to lead off this story with a bit of a controversial story going on out there. And in fact, if you're a Facebook fan of the Medicast, you can actually head over and listen to an alternate version of this news item that I recorded and then thought better of it. So if you're listening to this right now and you're a Facebook fan of the Medicast, you can go over and listen to my initial rant on some of the things that happened recently regarding the response to the blizzard that struck the central Atlantic coastal areas, the back-to-back snowstorms that just dumped tons of snow. And I'm actually going to have some more segments on some of that, including a dual interview with Rick Rosati from the Mitigation Journal in an upcoming episode. But what are we talking about here? There's been a lot of news on the Pittsburgh failures of their EMS system throughout this blizzard, how they were unable to get their ambulances to calls and were making people walk out to the ambulance and how horrible it was. Some people didn't get anybody to respond because they couldn't get close enough and they didn't get even, you know, and there was some discussion and some issues about walking people to the patients, you know, several blocks with equipment and stretchers and everything else through the snow. And so the initial story I found that kind of caused the biggest hubbub over this was an individual who had abdominal pain, called multiple times over 2 days for abdominal pains, had three separate dispatch attempts, according to the story I'm looking at, and were eventually the man died from his abdominal pain. So we don't know. The coroners are reviewing the case to find out exactly what he died from, but there's a lot of controversy over this because the emergency services director for Pittsburgh has really just thrown these EMS providers under the bus and has basically said this is a failure on the part of the multiple groups of paramedics who got their ambulances stuck in the snow and then didn't walk across the bridge and several blocks to this person's house to provide care and carry them out. You know, why are they throwing them under the bus like that? You know, there's no backup from above, which is my biggest concern. So this was an issue that caused a serious issue, and there were several different news articles discussing this. One article about a woman who had a sick infant. She has twin infants, and one of them has chronic health issues. She called for assistance. They were unable to get to her. They asked her to walk out to the ambulance, meet them halfway where they were kind of stuck and couldn't get any farther, and she was unable to do that because she had small children and her babies. And how was she going to carry all that through the snow? She ended up digging her car out herself and getting to the hospital on her own after a couple of hours of digging out the car. What does this say? Is this really a failure of Pittsburgh EMS? Is it a failure of emergency response planning in general for a really serious snowstorm that is a once in a decade or once every 20 year event? You know, this is the fact that these storms came so close together is what really causes a lot of the issue, I think, because they hadn't cleared the first snow before the second one came along and dumped more snow on top of things. But is this a failure or is it just, you know, an unfortunate series of events? And I think that's where I come from on this, is that I feel bad that this individual died. I feel bad that people were struggling and couldn't get medical attention. But this isn't something that happens every day. It isn't something that even in a city that might be prepared for more than just a few inches of snow at a time, you know, 30 inches of snow is 30 inches of snow, and there's no way to quickly dig out from under that. And if emergency services are stranded, people need to be able to rescue themselves. And sometimes people are going to die because you can't get them assistance fast enough. Now, several days, I don't know. You know, abdominal pain calls sometimes get shuffled out depending on how they dispatch, you know, they go through the emergency medical dispatch protocol. But the big problem I have here is the way that the response from the supervisors, management, and upper, I guess, politicos in the Pittsburgh system have really just not provided any kind of oversight and have not acknowledged that this was an extreme situation and a problem. The director of public safety, Michael Huss, was quoted as saying, "You get out of the damn truck and you walk to the residence." You know, I want to know, did these guys call for assistance? You know, and so let's go back and step back a second. We've all heard me talk about EMS providers of various levels making mistakes before. And I'm not going to second guess the decisions they made in a snap judgment in a situation that I wasn't there. So I always try to come back and say, what can I learn from this? What can I teach and relay to you all as I think is the lesson we can all take away from this? And here's the lesson I take from it. If you're a provider in the midst of a difficult situation and you can't get to your patient for some reason, the most important thing for you to do is to call over the public radio or on a recorded phone line and ask for a supervisor to tell you give you some thoughts about what you should do. Okay? You got to refer this type of thing up the food chain. And that way, you don't get hung out to dry when a management decision is made and you have to get your ambulance stuck. Do you abandon your ambulance? Do you find some way to haul all that equipment several blocks and then maybe try to haul a patient back out again? Do you try to find other resources to get through the snow? Individually. Well, that's not your job in the ambulance, but your job is to call for assistance and additional resources. That's part of our initial assessment, right? We get to a scene and we scene evaluate. We check and see what other resources we need. So this is one of those situations where you get your ambulance stuck, you can't get any closer, you call for additional resources. You call up the line, where's there a plow? Can I get a bucket loader? Can I get something? I need to speak to a supervisor. Can supervisor please contact me? And then you document that you had that conversation in your run sheet, and you document the outcome of that situation. No, we're going to call them back. You go ahead and return to station, get yourself dug out, and get back to the station for the next call, and we'll let you know if we need to dispatch you to this residence again. If that's the response you get, then you've covered yourself. You've gone up the food chain. And I have to think that that happened. If ambulances were getting stuck all over the city, somebody made a decision to say, we need to get the residents to walk out to us, which is a perfectly reasonable expectation in such an unusual situation. Unfortunately, we just can't get vehicles through 30 inches of snow unassisted, and patients need to find other ways to get themselves rescued and not just simply lay back and rely on the EMS system to come rescue them. I mean, we're there to do that, and we certainly want to do the best job we can. But I think that we also need to remember that we need to be safe in our scene and safe for ourselves, and make sure that we have the resources we need to get the job done before we put ourselves in the midst of a very difficult situation. So that's my less excited rant on the situation. You can hear more if you want. If you're a Facebook fan, head over to the MedicCast Facebook fan page. You can search for MedicCast on Facebook, and you will find the fan page for the MedicCast there. And you can listen to my alternative version of this. But this is my toned down, more relaxed version. And it's the reason why this episode didn't get posted on Sunday night like it usually does. It's getting posted on Monday morning because I wanted to sleep on it and maybe come back and re-record this segment. So we've covered two news stories. Let's cover a final story for the day, and maybe a little just as controversial as the Pittsburgh response issues is the story that popped up on my radar this week regarding the federal court to hear the 9/11 illness cases that have been alleged over the last, 10 years almost. 9/11 happened, and all of the debris and dust and materials around the scene after and during and after the response and during the cleanup caused some respiratory illnesses and other possible illnesses, according to a lot of claimants. Now, there's thousands of people claiming on this and want to have some kind of class action suit, but some of them have some kinds of seemingly spurious claims, I guess, would be what I would say. From one person in the article I found over at EMSresponder.com was a limo driver that only drove nearby the cleanup and claimed that he still inhaled things. I'm not sure I'd go that route. But anybody that actively participated in the response or the cleanup, as a contractor, as an emergency services worker, these individuals were working on a job, should have been provided the respiratory support and protection they needed. I know that it was an emergency response, and there wasn't any way to prepare adequately for that. But what happens? Does scene safety just go out the window? We need to protect our providers and our emergency workers. And certainly, I think that there were a lot of toxins in the dust, a lot of materials that were pulverized and made into very small particles that got down into the lungs. And we've had a lot of documented cases of individuals with severe lung damage following the 9/11 disaster from people that were in close contact with it. I don't know if somebody driving by has any claim. I wouldn't think so, but that'll be up to a court to decide. But certainly people that were called in to work at the scene have a claim to be compensated and covered for their medical expenses associated with a workplace injury or illness. And I think that that's what the judge is setting to do here. He's picked 12 different cases from the pool to try to set some precedents. So he's got a wide gamut of cases and claims so that the judge can then look at these cases and will use them, I think, to set a bellwether on who can make a valid claim, who might not be able to make a valid claim, if anyone. And so we'll look to find out more on this. And, unfortunately, I think if this goes to class action, which it looks like it might, we are going to, of course, have nobody really win but the lawyers. Time for this week's tip of the week, and I joined a new friend from the Maryland Poison Center, new for you guys at least. I've known Angel Bivens for a while since I took a toxicology community education class from her for nurses and paramedics to be able to teach about poison prevention in the communities in which we work. And so I've known Angel for a while, and she got in touch with me about the upcoming Poison Prevention Week and wanted to know if I could help share some ideas about setting up a local poison prevention planning program with the listeners. And I think it's a great idea. So I have put together this brief interview with Angel. I hope you will enjoy it and listen to it and use some of the ideas. She has a whole list of ideas she goes into in this particular segment, discussing what you can do to set up small, easy-to-run programs using resources from your local poison center to teach poison prevention to the various members of your patient community. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm here talking with Angel Bivens from the Maryland Poison Center. Now, you guys are all aware of and know Lisa Booz, who is the educational coordinator for medical professionals, but Angel, I think, works more with public education and outreach, and since Poison Prevention Week is just around the corner, I thought it would be great to talk to Angel about how the public is educated. Angel, did I get that right?
You totally have it right, Jamie.
Excellent. Well, now Poison Prevention Week is coming up March 14th through the 20th, and this is an opportunity for every poison center around the country to talk about and educate and build awareness about poison prevention and the access to the poison prevention centers. What kind of things are you doing here in the state of Maryland to support that?
Well, in the state of Maryland, we're trying to get information out to school children. I have a lot of school nurses and teachers who are gearing up to do a poison prevention lesson in their classrooms. Sometimes that happens during Poison Prevention Week. Sometimes it doesn't, just given the school calendar and what goes on curriculum-wise. We also do a poster contest every year where we ask elementary school students to draw their impressions of a poison safety message, and then we turn around and use that poster for the upcoming year throughout the state of Maryland.
Well, that's a great idea. Heck, I'm going to co-opt that for maybe EMS week.
There you go.
Each of the providers and the nurses listening to this, whether they're EMTs, paramedics, or nurses, have an opportunity to educate in their local region, even on a very small level. And every poison prevention center does have some level of resources available to do outreach to the public. And what can a person or a provider in their local area do to maybe get together some materials or information for their own Poison Prevention Week education?
Well, the interesting thing, poison centers are staffed, and most of their staffing resources go to the folks answering the phones. Some poison centers have a full-time public educator, some have part-time public educators, some have a specialist who wears the hat as an educator. So it's varying levels of education coordination at each individual poison center. But it's consistent throughout the whole entire country that poison center educators love to have the outside help from EMTs and nurses who are willing to go out and help get out a poison prevention message into the community. So the best thing for folks to do is to call the nationwide 800 number at 1-800-222-1222. That'll put you right to your local poison center. Simply ask the specialist to connect them to the education person at that given poison center. And believe me, the educator will be more than happy to share information and materials and stuff like that to anybody that's willing to help us get our message out.
I know that I've been through one of your training classes for becoming an educator on toxicology and this topic, and I had a lot of fun at your particular training session. but I know that there's a lot of information out there. Now, Poison Center, you know, if you're doing poison prevention education in your community, there's a lot of different things we can focus on. I know a lot of people, when they think poison prevention, they think that the kid got in and drank some of the drain cleaner or, you know, some of those child-based poisonings. But really, it spans everyone's entire lifespan as far as their risk factors. So what are some of the other areas that people should be focusing on if they were targeting a part of their patient population?
Well, there's a different message for every age level, even when you're talking about children. So, for instance, if you're talking about preschool children up through probably kindergarten or so, you're basically trying to get them to understand that they need to ask before they touch anything. Before they touch it, taste it, smell it. If they see something, they need to talk to a grown-up before they go any further with it. So that's your basic message for those little kids. When you're talking about your first and second and even third graders, these are the kids who, they're not babies anymore, so they know they're not supposed to eat things, but they get mixed up with lookalikes, medicines that look like candies and stuff like that, with drinks that are similar with products that are similar in color to a drink, and they might take a taste because it's in an inappropriate container. And they're also real susceptible to dares out on the parking lot or out on the schoolyard, where they'll come across something and somebody will dare somebody to taste it or to try it. Okay, so that's a message you need to cover there, is medicine safety and who's it safe to take medicine from, and watch out for lookalikes, and definitely don't take dares. As they get a little older, fourth, fifth grade, you start talking to them about reading product labels and how important the information is on the actual product labels. And we try to teach them to always read the product label, and that's important because we know as adults we tend to not do that. Moving into your middle schoolers, a wealth of things. You have substance abuse, you have inhalants, you have these children of this age group being babysitters, so they need to be aware of what the little ones could potentially get into and knowing that the poison center is available. And then high schoolers, you have some of them are teen parents, you have some of them in the workforce for the first time dealing with chemicals and things like that in the workforce, that they need to, again, use the proper safety precautions, trying to read the labels and stay safe and make sure they follow label directions. Moving into adults, you have substance abuse issues, you have suicides, you have taking care of young children, you have taking care of seniors. So there's a wealth of things going on in the adult population. And then seniors, we just need to try to remind them, hey, Poison Center is not just for families with little kids. We're for you too. If you mix up your medicines, give us a call. If you have, if you got confused with your medicines, give us a call. If you accidentally, you know, didn't put your glasses on and brush your teeth with a Bengay, give us a call. So you pretty much have the whole lifespan there, that poison centers have a message for everybody.
And there's no shortage of topic ideas there either. So I think no matter what, you could find something interesting to talk about in a variety of topics there. That's great. One of the things that I think leaps out to me is that poison centers, you know, are there to prevent getting patients to the hospital. So if you're a nurse working in the emergency department, or you know, you're in the EMS field and you're dealing with patients that suspect they have a poisoning or a problem going on, they don't necessarily have to go to the hospital. And I was surprised when Lisa Booz once taught me very early in the process how much poison prevention centers actually help to keep people from taking up emergency resources and things in the hospitals and ambulances.
That's true. The nationwide statistic is that anywhere from 70 to 75% of calls that come into the poison center are managed safely and effectively right on site without the need for additional healthcare resources, whether it be paramedics, whether it be the emergency room. So that provides a huge healthcare dollar savings. It also, more importantly, keeps those emergency providers there and on the ready for true emergencies. There is nothing worse than having a paramedic have to go to the household of a small child who ingested some bleach, which is not that big of a deal, where they would have been better served driving the other way down the street because somebody's having a heart attack.
Great. Well, I know that's something that I talk about a lot, and I just think it's important to stress that putting together a poison prevention program in your facility or in your community to assist your local poison center will help reduce some of the load on the system, and educating the public about other resources certainly is a way to do that.
That's great, and that's exactly why we are very happy to have the paramedics and the nurses and et cetera get involved in the community to try to help, let people know that the services of the poison center are there. They're there 24/7. I mean, we don't close no matter what happens, and there's always somebody there, a phone call away.
Great. Well, would you like to give us the phone number one more time and the dates for Poison Prevention Week so maybe they can get planning?
Sure. The phone number where you can reach your local poison center is 1-800-222-1222. That number works all over the country. It's a smart number, like 911. It knows where you're calling from, so it puts you right to the exact poison center that you're supposed to be talking to. And this year, we celebrate Poison Prevention Week, March 14th through the 20th. That's the week that's the national observance, but those of us in the land of poison centers like to point out that every week is Poison Prevention Week. You don't just have to do something that one week of the year. We are happy to have help anytime throughout the year.
And so it's a great opportunity to set up summer programs and, you know, anything like that. We can plan ahead and look towards the rest of the whole year.
That's true. A lot of the, I know here in Maryland, there are a couple of fire stations that actually do safety villages and safety camps for kids. And many of them do incorporate a poison prevention message, which we are just thrilled because those are kids that we ordinarily wouldn't be reaching out to. So kind of think outside the box a little bit and think about ways that you can incorporate your message. Call your poison center, see if they'll give you some magnets to put on the ambulance unit so that if you do get a call to a family of a small child and it's not something you have to transport, you can give them that magnet and say, you know what, call these folks the next time.
Great. Well, Angel, thank you very much for sharing with my listeners. I know that they're going to be excited about putting some more programs in place for poison prevention in their community over the coming year. And I really appreciate all the support that we've gotten from the Maryland Poison Center.
Well, Jamie, we truly appreciate all the support that you are giving us and getting the Poison Center's message out to the paramedics and folks out there across the country. Thanks.
I want to thank Angel Bivens from the Maryland Poison Center. You can find more over at mdpoison.com. And like I've always told you with Lisa, Lisa puts out the Tox Tidbits newsletter. If you haven't signed up for that email notification to let you know when you can go download the latest PDF version of that newsletter, it's a great way for you to get a simple one-page update on some kind of toxicology issue, something you can put on the bulletin board in the station, let your coworkers know what's going on. It's great for training officers just to have something to give out on a regular basis. And you don't have to be from the state of Maryland to sign up for that because you can just download all that stuff right off the web. And again, that's mdpoison.com. Use your poison center resources when you have them available and make use of those things and reach out to your community. You know, you might save yourself a run by spreading the word about your local poison center. Time to close out the show, and I want to remind all of you that you can find links to everything we talked about in this episode, and of course every other episode, over at the MedicCast blog, mediccast.com/blog. You'll find a link right at the top of the page for show notes. Click on that, and the most recent episode will always be at the top of the page, and then you can just scroll down and look at previous episodes if you're looking for a past show. But anything you're looking for, news items, tip of the week resources, all are available there. And we have a lot of good tip of the week resources that go along with this week's Poison Prevention Week, including some resources from the CDC and also from the National Poison Center website. If you want to get in touch with me with a comment, a correction, a link, or anything, just go ahead and send those emails in. The emails come in to podmedic@mac.com. You can also call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC will get you in here to the MedicCast voicemail line. I also want to urge you to leave comments over on the blog. Any of the show notes, you can leave a comment right below the show notes. There's a link at the top and the bottom of the page. You can also always leave comments on any of the articles over at the MedicCast site, and we encourage you to do that. It's a great way to get a discussion out there with the other visitors that are checking in at the site from time to time. Don't forget, you can also catch up with me via Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic, twitter.com/podmedic, and go ahead and search for the MedicCast Facebook page. If you haven't already done so, get on there. I'm pushing for 1,000 fans over at the MedicCast Facebook page. We just crossed the 600 mark. I think we can keep pushing out there. So if you're on Facebook and you haven't gone and found the MedicCast Facebook fan page, become a fan of the MedicCast now. Time to close out the show with some PodSafe music. Song I've played, I think, in the past recently. This is Joe College, and he's doing a cover of the Three Dog Night song, Shambhala. So if you like this song, you'll find a link in the show notes for Joe's link and webpage. You can follow up on that. You can also follow the link to the iTunes store. There's a button right there, and it's a great way to show your support. Spend $1.29 or 99 cents, whatever it is, to buy one of these songs, support these artists, and thank them for sharing their excellent music with you, the podcast listener. That's it for me. I'll remind all of you, I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. I'll be back again next week with another episode of the MedicCast. And until then, remember, scene safety, BSI.
Wash away my troubles, wash away my pain with the rain of Shambhala. Wash away my sorrow, wash away my shame with the rain of Shambhala. Shambhala. Everyone is lucky, everyone is so kind on the road to Shambhala. Shambhala.